asking the questions mainstream journalists will never ask. This is your Richie Allen Show on richieallen.co.uk, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, and triggerwarning.tv.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. Brazil says it won't accept funding offered by G7 countries to help tackle forest fires in the Amazon. A G7 summit at the weekend agreed $22 million should be sent to the region to aid the fight against a record number of blazes. But Brazil says it doesn't need the money and says foreign powers are trying to assert control in the region. Opposition leaders in the UK say they've agreed a strategy to avoid a no-deal Brexit. They've decided to focus efforts on passing legislation in Parliament which can head off that scenario. The talks were called by Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, who had suggested being a caretaker Prime Minister if the government loses a vote of no confidence. A vote of no confidence is still being considered as an option, but many opposition MPs say they couldn't accept Mr. Corbyn as a caretaker PM. Iran says it won't enter dialogue with the US unless Washington lifts sanctions. At the G7 summit in Biarritz, President Trump said he would be open to a meeting with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani in the right circumstances. The US pulled out of the international deal last year, which is designed to limit Iran's nuclear program. Australia's Foreign Affairs Minister Maurice Payne's expressed disappointment and concern after the formal arrest of Chinese-Australian writer Yang Hengjun in Beijing. Yang's been charged in China with spying. Arthur Stevens reports from Melbourne.
Dr. Yang's lawyer believes the charges could be in relation to spying for Australia. Foreign Minister Maurice Payne holds serious concerns for his welfare and the harsh conditions under which he's been held in Beijing for more than 7 months. Senator Payne says China hasn't explained the reasons for Dr. Yang's detention, nor has it allowed him access to his lawyers or family visits, and has called for basic standards of justice and procedural fairness to be met. Dr. Yang, a former diplomat with China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs who became a pro-democracy campaigner and an Australian citizen in 2002, was detained in Guangzhou after arriving from the US in January. Arthur Stevens, Melbourne.
The US President's National Security Advisor is set to make a visit to Ukraine, although no official dates have been announced. John Bolton's trip comes after he met with his Russian counterpart in Jerusalem in June. Ross Cullen has more from Moscow.
In December last year, John Bolton said the chances of a second summit between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin were very low, arguing it was hard to see how a summit could take place with Russia still holding the Ukrainian ships and crews it detained in November 2018. And while there's still no chance of another round of talks between the two leaders at the moment, the US National Security Advisor has been making moves in the region for dialogue. His latest trip to Ukraine, announced on Twitter as the G7 summit wrapped up, comes as the new Ukrainian president Volodymyr Zelensky is expected to make his first trip to Washington to meet the US leader. Mr. Bolton said the Trump administration is getting behind what he called Zelensky's vision to create a stronger Ukraine. Ross Cullen, Moscow.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Yeah, and thank you very much, Ollie Barrett. Thank you very much indeed. Tuesday, August 27th, 2019. I'm back. How you doing? Are you well? Good to be with you. Sweltering afternoon here in Salford in Greater Manchester. My name is Richie Allen. Thrilled to be talking to you again. Tweet the programme right now. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Couldn't be simpler. Tweet me and I'll be reading your tweets out through the programme as we go along. First show of the week after the bank holidays. Good, it's good to be alive, I tells you.
Richie Allen.
Marvellous.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Well, I don't have to tell you too much about Jordan Maxwell, the terrific author, researcher. He's a bit of a doyen, I think, of independent thinking and independent research. He's been at it for over 60 years, an old friend, and it's been a long time since he was on the programme. He reminded me of that over the weekend and I said, well, let's do a show today. And Jordan joins me in about a half an hour. We'll have an extended conversation, he and I and you, us three, we three. We'll have a chat and we'll see where he's been and what he's been doing since the last time he was on the programme. I've already given you the Twitter handle, so do get in touch with the show. It's live right now on Faber Radio 2 in Manchester. My website, richieallen.co.uk, triggerwarning.tv and TuneIn Radio as well. And you know it's archived. It's archived, be Jesus, on iTunes, on Spotify, the Truth Seeker app from the App Store. and lots of other places as well. Thanks so much for the lovely messages. I've had a lovely 2 weeks off. I put a little video out today where I just said the same thing, but a nice time. Didn't go anywhere. I look very tanned, but I assure you, we didn't go anywhere. We've got a very old dog, and we moved in, as you know, about 3 months ago to a new house, so going somewhere was completely out of the question. But the weather was pretty decent over the time that I had off, and we got out and about quite a bit. Lovely walks, villages, lovely. And I'm a bit tanned. We'll see how long that lasts. So we will. I missed you. I genuinely mean that. Much as I really needed the break, I missed chatting away with you because I love doing that. So hi to Julie, to Paul, to Gail, to Anonymous in Western Massachusetts, to Annalise. How you doing, Annalise? And to everybody else who's tweeting right now, to Chris Davies. How you doing, Chris? To Matt, to Patrick Vidian. How you doing, Patrick? And to Animal Rights Photo, who sent me a link to a story about vegan activists breaking into an abattoir. I did come across that today. Timely, because I've been thinking quite a bit about the food we get and where we get it from of late, as you might remember. Hi to Andy Newman, to Mwinga as well, my only black friend. Although I might have two now. I think I have two, don't I? Don't I? Hi to Martin in Spain. Thanks for the meme, Martin. Hi to Phil as well, to Steve James. And right, we better move on, because before Jordan joins me, it's time to have a look at the news. Now, if you were listening to Ollie Barrett, you would have heard Ollie say that opposition members of Parliament want to block a no-deal Brexit by passing legislation. We're about 2 months away from the deadline, the October 31st deadline, when Boris Johnson, the UK Prime Minister, has said, and he's on the record, you know, that we either have a deal with the European Union or we don't. And if we don't, we leave on October 31st. Sans deal, sans deal. Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn called a meeting. They met. The Lib Dems, the SNPs, Plaid Cymru, no idea how to say that. Green Party, the Green Party, one person, I think, or is there two or three Green MPs? I can't remember. I'm still kind of half on holiday. I'll catch up. So they all met anyway, and they sat down and said, right, we have to stop no deal from happening. But they didn't give any details as to how they would do it or when they would try to do that. Legislate for it. Downing Street's source told the media today that these people want to sabotage the UK's position and make talks with the European Union more difficult. The Downing Street source even said the talks were making progress. Johnson has said, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, that he's fairly confident there will be a deal. Here's Jeremy Corbyn, and Jeremy sounds his usual full of beans self, a bastion of optimistic speech making, this man. He's so exciting. Listen to him.
The priority is to prevent a no-deal exit from the European Union because of all the damage it would do to people's jobs, economy and our relationships with the rest of the world. So we've just had a discussion this morning with all the other opposition parties and agreed that I will put forward a proposal which will make sure that Parliament is able to debate a legislative way of preventing the government crashing us out with no deal. And that was an agreement reached with all the opposition parties this morning at my invitation.
Yeah, he's full of life, isn't he? He's full of piss and vinegar. Piss and vinegar, more like it, is Jeremy. There's a prisoner of his own conscience right there, children. Dreadful. Let's hear from the Lib Dems in the guise of their leader, Joe Swinston.
We're in a moment of national crisis with the prospect of crashing out of the EU without a deal. I think the best way to avoid that is for the House of Commons to pass a law that requires the government to request an extension of Article 50. I think the purpose for that would be ideally to hold a people's vote. And that would be able to set us on the path to avoiding no deal. But I think we need a triple lock, if you like. We need to think about what happens if that fails. And we could end up in a scenario where there is a general election, in which case it's vital that any election gives the choice to people rather than having that taken away from them. So we shouldn't crash out of the EU during a general election campaign.
Yeah, let's suspend. Well, she went on to say we should be able to revoke Article 50 entirely. if we get our own way. But let's extend it. Extend it, why not? And have a people's vote, why not? And all of that old jazz. Dreadful, so I'm not going to dwell on it. You know where I stand, I think, now. I think you might do. Nigel Farage, the leader of the Brexit Party, was in London, announcing, he was today, that his party has got the 650-plus candidates ready to contest every single seat in the country in the event of a general election. And it's looking fairly likely, the election, you would have thought, right? So he was cock-a-hoop, was Nigel. And he took every opportunity to tell the assembled media that most of the 650-plus prospective candidates are not politicians and don't have any political background. Yeah. So Nigel doesn't trust Boris Johnson to leave the European Union in a clean break or sans deal. As I said, he doesn't trust Johnson, and he reminds Sky News why he doesn't trust Johnson.
Bear this in mind. Twice Boris Johnson voted against the new European treaty, the withdrawal agreement. He did so saying, you know, that it would entrap us, it would enslave us, it was a disastrous deal for Britain. And then, on the third time of asking, he voted for it. So there is a big question. Not just can we trust the Conservative Party, clearly we can't on its own, can we trust Boris Johnson? Maybe the threat of the Brexit Party, maybe the realisation that if he goes back to the withdrawal agreement, he has got no chance of winning outright the next general election. Maybe we can just concentrate his minds and get the result that we want.
There is no version of the withdrawal deal, is there, that you would support? I mean, obviously, backstop goes, that's a given. But are there modifications to the trade elements that you would actually smile upon?
Well, there are no trade elements other than its intention through the withdrawal agreement and the political declaration to keep us locked inside the customs union in perpetuity. That's the ambition of Monsieur Barnier. It'll be very difficult to break out of it. It won't take back our territorial waters. It'll cost us $39 billion. It'll mean the ECJ has jurisdiction here for a minimum period of 8 years. There's no other way of looking at this than the worst deal in history.
Now, everything Farage said there is verifiably true about the deal. So if Johnson says, well, we've come to some arrangement to remove the backstop, right, with the Northern Ireland backstop, so because we've removed that, we can agree on a deal and we can sign it and we will leave. We won't leave. Farage has just explained why. No deal with the European Union is tantamount to leaving it. They're all liars. And I know, even though you've missed me for 2 weeks and I've missed you, I can hear you groan. So we're going to leave European Union business for today. Because it says 13 minutes past the hour. This is the Richie Allen Show. Live from Salford in Greater Manchester, Tuesday, October, me arse. It's August the 27th, that's right. Getting ahead of yourself there. October 31st. They're all liars, all of them. Liars. Did you know that Louis Mountbatten was killed 40 years ago today by the IRA? Mountbatten, his grandson Nicholas and two others were blown up in a fishing boat in Mullaghmore. Take the boy out of Ireland for 17 plus years and his pronunciations go out the window. They were blown up by the IRA, Mullaghmore County, Sligo, 40 years ago today, 1979. Who was Louis Mountbatten? Well, he was a British Royal Navy officer and he was an uncle of Prince Philip. Yes, that Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh. And he was a second cousin once removed of the Queen. And in the Second World War, he was the Supreme Allied Commander, South East Asia Command. So we got about did Louis Mountbatten. Now, Andrew Lowney, that's L-O-W-N-I-E, because I know that some of you might want to look this guy up. Andrew Lowney is a historian, and he's written a book called The Mountbattens, Their Lives and Loves. And his research into Louis Mountbatten threw up some very interesting things for him, for the author. But we knew about some of these things, but they never really saw the light of day in the mainstream media. Right, so anyway, Andrew Lowney sets out to write a book about the Mountbattens, Lives and Loves, and he found out some things that he didn't know about. And this is the way it goes. You know, a lot of people don't know this stuff. So anyway, before we hear from Andrew Lowney, you probably know, but it's worth repeating because you might be new to the programme. Mountbatten was well known as a mentor to Charles, Prince Charles. He had a very, very close relationship with him, which included helping Charles find women at one time. Yes, he organised dates for Charles, because Charles was a bit awkward, a bit foppish, apparently. He couldn't do it for himself. So Louis Mountbatten would bring young women to a country home in Broadlands, and he would inflict upon these young women the jug-eared goon that we know today as Prince Charles. Now, you might not know, but Louis Mountbatten was also a very close friend of Jimmy Savile's. Yes, that Jimmy Savile, the record-breaking paedophile Jimmy Savile. Right, so this afternoon, our Kay Burley, we love Kay, the Ginger Ninja, she had the historian and author Andrew Lowney on to talk about his new book about the Mountbattens and their loves and loves, or whatever the bloody hell. And after a lot of nonsense about Louis Mountbatten's wife, Edwina, and her infidelity, and Mountbatten's own fidelity, and Kay found this very amusing, very skittish was Kay today, Burley eventually gets to ask a couple of serious questions. Question number one, and this is in sequence now, Kay says to Andrew Lowney, how did Edwina, Mountbatten's wife, how did she die?
She died in very, very mysterious circumstances on a tour in Borneo in 1960, suddenly, literally just collapsed through hard work and overwork. I mean, there were a lot of rumours around her death, which I didn't find stood up. So I think she just worked herself to death. She drove herself. She was very competitive and worked, in some ways, felt in his shadow, and she had to do better than him. And I think she just did too much travelling and was just exhausted.
What kind of fuckery is this?
Andrew, hang on, Andrew. How did she die again?
She was very competitive and worked, in some ways, felt in his shadow, and she had to do better than him. And I think she just did too much travelling and was just exhausted.
She worked really hard. She was competitive and she wanted to be better than him. And she just worked too hard and she was exhausted, so she died. You hear that, Tom?
No. Could you repeat it? Because I can't believe my fucking ears.
I can't believe it either. So let's hear it once more. How did his wife die? This is all relevant now. How did she die again? How did she die?
She was very competitive and worked, in some ways, felt in his shadow, and she had to do better than him. And I think she just did too much travelling and was just exhausted.
Oh, yeah. I'm in danger of dying in that case, because the future Mrs. Allen is far more intelligent and far greater an accomplished person than I am, with degrees and qualifications coming out of her backside. And I am very competitive, and I do want to be better than the future Mrs. Allen. So maybe, on hearing the news of the unfortunate demise of Edwina Mountbatten, I might reconsider my competitiveness. Holy shit, right? So it was crazy. So Kay then asks about the young boys and Mountbatten, because in his research for his book, Andrew Lowney discovered something that we knew, you and I knew, or suspected, and that is that Louis Mountbatten had a penchant for young boys. So Kay asks him, good girl, Kay.
And he decided to experiment with sex, with the same sex, young boys particularly, he's alleged to have been attracted to. Did that only happen after she died?
It's very difficult to tell. I mean, the FBI...
Brilliant question by Kay. So he developed an interest in young boys, very young boys. Did that penchant, did that develop after the wife died? Because if it was going on while the wife was alive, you see, Andrew, you see where I'm going with this. It might have something to do with why the wife died mysteriously. Anyway, when did it start?
The FBI opened a file on him in 1944, talking that saying that he had relationships with young boys. And that, so clearly that was before she died. There were three different sources that they had in files going over 30 years. So that seemed to be quite persuasive. Though clearly intelligence agencies pick up information, doesn't mean it's true. But I then talked to two boys who'd been in Kinkora who gave me information they couldn't possibly have got unless they, I think, they'd gone through the experience they went through. And these were boys that I found were not paid, in fact, didn't want to talk about the whole experience, have actually legal cases going through. But there have been other stories. The wartime driver has published a story in New Zealand about this. So I think it goes right back. And there are 20 different sources in the book talking about these bisexual affairs, including a man who was his lover during the 1970s, who I had lunch with only last week.
Some of the people that he had
gay sex with were younger than others.
Very good, Kay. Very good. And I say very good because the vast majority of presenters in the UK would leave it at the FBI revelations and say, all right, okay, I move on. But Borley wants to nail down the point here that this is not just a gay fella who's sleeping with 17, 16, 17, 18-year-old guys, even though 16 is beneath the age of consent. It was then, I think it is now. I'm not sure. I'll double-check and get back to you. But she wants to nail down that the allegations, and there are numerous allegations, that the boys were young. Good. Ma on Colleen, as we would say in Ireland. Ma on Colleen means good girl. It's not meant to be condescending or misogynistic. Good stuff, Kay Burley. What does he say?
Than others.
Well, the boys from Kinkora were 16 at the time. And I think there's a lot of evidence that this man, Norman Neal, the wartime driver, talked about young boys of even 8 to 12. But that's, you know, that clearly is very difficult as a historian to corroborate.
Those are allegations.
Those are allegations. Yeah. But there's clearly a consistency about the comments. And certainly since the book came out only this week, I've had quite a lot of people come to me with other stories backing up what I've said in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my sources is a man called Ron Perks, who was a chauffeur in 1948. He's a man now in his 90s. And he told me about how he drove Mountbatten to show him where a male brothel was in Malta when he was there after the war. But there are lots of stories. I talked to a Major General this morning who told me about how Mountbatten set up a young guards officer in a flat near where Mountbatten lived in Knightsbridge.
Mm.
So I think there's quite a lot of evidence. I mean, this is one chapter in the book. It's a chapter I call Rumours. I put the evidence down. I leave people to make up their own minds.
Yeah.
But there seems to be a consistency here.
A consistency here. He goes on to say there's 30 chapters in the book that deal with Mountbatten's time in India, in the war, the wife and all the rest of it. It sounds like the sort of fodder that will eventually find its way into a BBC serial drama. But he was a very close friend of Jimmy Savile's. He was incredibly close to his young great-nephew. Charles introduced him to girls. It's believed that his tendency towards young boys was going on while his wife was alive. The wife died in incredibly mysterious circumstances. Yeah, you see, it's very interesting this, you see. And of course, it couldn't be more timely with the questions faced by, not that I don't think he will ever, in fact, I should say, not that I believe for a minute that Prince Andrew will ever answer, nor will he be asked to answer, nor will he be summoned to answer. For his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, the convicted paedophile who, of course, died in very mysterious circumstances himself a couple of days after I took my holiday, of course. It's a cesspit, is what it is. And while all of that's going on, of course, people are working very hard in the UK media to dismiss out of hand any notion of a powerful, elite paedophile ring operating in this country and around the world. The media is doing all it can to debunk this and to claim that it's just fantasy and it is the work of attention seekers and lunatics. And yet, drip, 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 it comes out, it comes out, it comes out, it comes out. This is the Richie Allen Show, by the way. Welcome to it. 23 and a half minutes it is past the hour. It is the 27th of August 2019. I'm hoping Jordan Maxwell will join me in a few minutes' time. It's all been agreed, it's all set up, but I don't see him there yet, but it is early, and we have a few more things to talk about in the meantime. Anywho, so we'll do that, and we'll raise Jordan and get him on the programme. So she sold millions of books. In fact, she sold hundreds of millions of books. More than any other children's author in history. And she's the seventh most successful author of all time. I've read possibly hundreds of her books myself, and she was responsible for this. Come on. Come on, you all fancy Dan, be honest. Or George. This is the famous five then, right? So we're talking about Enid Blyton, of course. Lovely. I read all the books. I read the Secret Seven books. I even read the books about girls' boarding schools, Mallory Towers and all of that. I read all of that when I was younger. But Enid Blyton shouldn't be, can't be commemorated on a coin because apparently she was a racist and a homophobe. She was a racist, apparently. And this has blown up in the last couple of days. The story is new, but this goes back a couple of years when the Royal Mint had their people in, the people who decide, the people who talk it out and decide who gets commemorated by having their image pressed onto the country's coins. And apparently Enid Blyton, well, you would have thought she was a shoo-in. You would have thought she was a shoo-in. But no, apparently they had a discussion about putting her on a 50 pence piece, I believe. And because of her racist homophobia, they decided against it. Not because the committee was overly triggered by Enid Blyton themselves, but they worried about a backlash. They thought the snowflakes in the country would go absolutely bananas if Enid Blyton was put onto a coin. Yeah. So the Royal Mint's Advisory Committee met 3 years ago. The meeting's minutes were obtained under a Freedom of Information request, I think, by the Daily Mail. Well done, the Daily Mail, for getting this story. And they found that she was basically decided not to use Enid because of some of her opinions and because of some of the characters and some of the books and some of the stories. Now, Kehinde Andrews is a black university professor, I think University of Birmingham. I've seen him on TV a few times. I should have double-checked today. I don't want to insult the man, but I think it's Birmingham. And he was on GMB, Good Morning Britain, this morning to talk about this. And he agrees with the decision, does Kehinde Andrews, not to commemorate Enid Blyton's success with a commemorative coin. Well, because, well, you know, well, she was racist.
Commemoration's about what we do now, right? Mm-hmm. And we have this strange commemorative culture where everybody that we kind of reminisce about should get a stamp or a coin or a statue. And that's not the point. Commemoration says, what do we value today? And the reason why Enid Blyton isn't worthy of a commemorative coin, exactly the same reason they cut the G words out of Noddy. It's just wildly inappropriate. She was racist. Her books were racist. They were heterosexist. They had a really narrow view of Britain.
You mean racist because of the black doll?
No, it's not just the black doll. It's the story, some of the stories in these books. If you look at, there's a story called The Black Doll, where the black doll is really dark and ugly and runs away and gets washed in the rain and comes back white and everybody loves him. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are racist stories. Mm-hmm. And so what the committee said was, yes, she's popular, but actually, because of that racism in the 21st century, that's not
something we want to support. However, they said it was because of the backlash. They were concerned about a backlash exactly. from the public because of it. Can we not celebrate her, though, from the point of view that she is the seventh most successful author of all time? She had, there's no doubt she's inspired generations and generations of readers because they read her books as children. And yes, of course, you know, we look at subject matters, characters, the way things are written now with different eyes to how they were at the time.
Why do we have to commemorate her? I mean, you can celebrate her. It doesn't wipe her out of history to say that actually the values in her books are not values in the 21st century.
Would you remove her books from libraries, say, or from bookshops?
I wouldn't say that. I would say we should ban Enid Blyton and get rid of her. But there is a reality. The Centre for Literary History Education did a study called the Reflecting Realities. In 2017, only 1% of books published in this country had a black or Asian character as a main character.
Kehinde Andrews. I'm sure there'll be a few strong opinions on that there. Who hasn't read Enid Blyton? Mark Best tweets, put Noddy on the coins. Thanks, Mark. Hi to Paddy Mick. Steve James tweets, when the royal family had an issue of being exposed, Prince Philip simply gave MI6 a ring. Don't know about that, Steve, but maybe he did. Maybe he did. Faisal said, how you, Faisal? Let me scroll on down there, because I saw a tweet of yours a second ago there. Let me see. I retweeted it. At which point of travelling too much does it kill you then? I'm just curious. This is Faisal. That's in reference to the strange and mysterious death of Edwina Mountbatten, who died in Borneo. 1960 or 61 or in the 60s. And she died of, she was very competitive. And she was working very hard to equal the exploits of her husband. And she was just exhausted is all. And she just died is all. That's what happened is all. Is all. Right, okay. It's 29 and a smidgen minutes past the hour. Going to take a tune. When I come back, hopefully Jordan Maxwell will be with me. He's not signed in just yet. It wouldn't be his form to forget. We only spoke last night, so I'm pretty sure we'll get him on. We'll get stuck into a conversation with him as well. Hi to Cliff Moore as well. How you doing, Cliff? And Andy Newman says, to paraphrase Stan Laurel, Richie, Edwina died of a Sunday. Died of a Sunday, yeah. Welcome to the programme. It's Tuesday. And it's August 27th. Fab Radio 2, triggerwarning.tv, richieallen.co.uk, and TuneIn Radio. This is The Vapors on your Richie Allen Show. Keep the tweets coming in.
I got your picture. In colour, your hair is brown, your eyes are hazel, and soft as clouds. I often kiss you when there's no one else around.
Turning Japanese on the Richie Allen Show. The time is exactly 26 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. No sign of Jordan Maxwell just yet. Won't panic. He might have been waylaid or delayed. We'll give him that a few minutes, and if we don't get him, we'll move on. I kind of had a funny feeling this morning, actually. Even though we spoke last night, I kind of had a funny feeling. The time zones are all right, proper, accurate. We know the time zones, and we'll just wait and see what happens. We'll wait and see. We'll give him a few minutes. In the meantime, I'm not going to get into this. And I did say this to my close friend and colleague, my great friend, Jean-Ann Crowley, this morning. I'm not going to get into this, but I've been asked a few questions. And I don't ignore you. When you ask me questions, I don't ignore you. But I don't want to get into it in any great depth. About a week or so ago, I was made aware, because I was on holiday, and I wasn't reading the newspapers. When I when I don't work, I am a stickler for not watching the news or reading the newspapers. In fact, I'm very... Yeah, a stickler is a good word, really. I'm completely reticent to get involved, to read anything. I mean, obviously, when Epstein was found dead in his cell, of course, obviously I had to have a look at that, and I did, and I read a bit about it, and I saw what people were saying, and I read the US press, and I read the British press, and the Irish press, but by and large, I don't get involved. But a week or so ago, I became aware that the Guardian newspaper had published a story basically taken directly from an organisation in the UK called Hope Not Hate, which is allegedly an anti-racism organisation. And Hope Not Hate had done a feature on the Brexit Party, but also on this particular programme. And it had criticised Brexit Party politicians, MEPs now, because they had a terrific showing in the European election, which I still can't believe we're talking about. I still can't believe that we had European Union elections in this country 3 years after we voted to leave. Well, nearly 3 years after we voted to leave. But anyway, we did. And I had quite a few different Brexit Party people on the programme, talked about Brexit and all the rest of it. So Hope Not Hate put out this thing and was critical of these politicians for coming on this programme because of other people who have appeared on this programme in the past. A number of you have been asking me about this today. I had no intentions of getting into it, but seeing as Jordan is late, or way late or delayed, I'll briefly get into it. But I'm not dignifying these people, the Jewish Chronicle, nor Hope Not Hate. I'm not dignifying them. But it's very interesting, this situation, that we're seeing a lot of more and more and more this kind of guilt by association. You have a situation where an organisation claiming to be a charity that wants to root out racism, desperate to go after the Brexit Party for being the Brexit Party, I suppose, being pro leaving the European Union, being committed to leaving the European Union. So they're turning over every stone they can find to find ways of criticising the Brexit Party. So, aha, lovely. We see that they went on a programme with a guy who's interviewed people with very strong opinions about Israel, but also people who have denied the Holocaust, people who have said that they don't believe in the gas chambers and they don't believe that the Holocaust ever happened. So the Jewish Chronicle picked this up as well and ran with it for 5 days. Five different stories in the Jewish Chronicle. One or two in The Guardian, there was one in The Mail, I think, running with this story, that these people had the temerity. It was an outrage that they would come and appear on a programme like this because of some of the other opinions expressed on it. So I tweeted the editor of the Jewish Chronicle, a guy called Stephen Pollard, and while I was sarcastic in my tweet, I certainly wasn't abusive, pointed out the absolute folly of criticising people for appearing on a programme just because somebody else happened to appear on that programme at some time or another. Pollard decided to block me then and not engage me. So you've been asking me, oh, what do you think about this? What are you going to do about it? I'm not going to do anything about it. I wouldn't dignify these people. I don't even... there was a time when I would extend an offer to these people. I would say, look, let's have a chat. Come on the programme. And they won't. And I suppose that's the lesson. Let's forget about the Jewish Chronicle. Let's forget about the Guardian. Forget about the Daily Mail. Forget about all of these people. Incidentally, Peter Tatchell gave them short shrift when they asked him, why did you go on a programme that has hosted Holocaust deniers? Tatchell said, I'll go on any programme I'm asked to go on, because if some members of that audience have negative opinions about gays and lesbians, well, at least maybe I get a chance to change their mind. Good man. That's about the size of it. So anyway, what is interesting here, and I spend a lot of time, I think, over the years, especially on this programme, talking about how the media operates. And there's a very interesting point to be made here. And I hope, well, I'm pretty sure you will have gotten the point, but many people won't have gotten the point. I wonder how many people read the article in The Guardian, read the one in The Mail, read the one in the Jewish Chronicle, the several in the Jewish Chronicle, or even read the press release by Hope Not Hate. How many of those people would have thought to themselves, why is there no comment from this radio presenter, Richie Allen? Where's the comment from Richie? Here they are saying that Richie is a bit of a lousy bastard because he talks to all these hateful people. And nobody should go on his programme. But yet there's no comment from Alan himself. And I reckon because of the way things are today, because of the paradigm, because of people's... well, because of people's ignorance about the way things work, I reckon very few people would be savvy enough to say, why wasn't Alan contacted for comment by the Guardian newspaper? Because I can tell you, as somebody who has been, I've been a journalist now for many, many, many years, you don't go on radio programmes and you don't write articles criticising people for doing something or saying something without first of all giving them right of reply. It is one of the most important parts of journalism, one of the most important facets of the job. Somebody's going to get a shellacking on the programme. Give them a heads up before you publish and ask them for a comment. But obviously nobody from The Guardian, nobody from this organisation Hope Not Hate, nor did anybody from the Jewish Chronicle have the professional courtesy to phone me up, and my number is out there, you know, to say, right, we're going with this. Why do you have all these hateful people on your programme? I would have been happy to give them a comment. That's an important point. I'm sure it wasn't lost on you. But this is how the media landscape has changed over the years. Okay, this is how it operates now. It decides now to attack a platform, because I don't personally feel very attacked. I'm not being attacked. I couldn't give an arse, really. But let's attack this platform. Let's attack it. Let's criticise it and call it a safe haven for hate mongers. But let's not give right of reply to the chap who produces, edits and introduces the programme. Let's not do that. And I wonder how many people reading the Hope Not Hate press releases, because this was discussed on national radio. I understand. I've not heard the clips yet, but my programme has been discussed on national radio. But nobody had the decency to phone me up to say, what do you think, boy? What do you think there, Alan? Surely you've got an... Well, yeah, thanks, I do, actually. As it happens, let me explain why it is I speak to people that other people might find odious. Let me tell you why I don't find them particularly odious, even though I might stringently disagree with them on certain points and maybe on lots of things. But let me tell you why I don't find them odious. Let me tell you why I like speaking to them. And it's not just for the hell of it. It's not just for the controversy of it. But no, no call from any of these organisations. And that's very, very interesting. And I wonder how many people who read newspapers in 2019 would have said to themselves, why doesn't the paper say, Richie Allen said this, or when contacted by The Guardian, Richie Allen declined to comment? How many people read it and went, this is a bit of a hatchet job, this, isn't it? Bit of a hatchet job. Right, we're streaming very, very strongly across multiple platforms. Everything is hunky-dory. One or two of you need to check your own browsers. We're flying here, and I have it monitored, of course, elsewhere, as I've told you before. No sign of Jordan yet. Isn't that just typical? As you come back after 2 weeks off, Jordan speaks, oh, I'd love to come back on, Richie. Tomorrow's brilliant, Richie. It works perfect. We agree the time, and he just isn't there. And I've tried to ring him, and he's not answering. So, that's okay. That's okay, you see. These things happen, and we're prepared for it. So when we hear some Lou Reed, as we'll do right now, I'll come back and we'll go another way. How about that? We'll be right back. Ah, the brilliance of Lou Reed on the Richie Allen Show, song called Vicious from the album Transformer. Listened to a lot of music when I was off, of course. Listened to a lot of music and got back into that album, which I hadn't heard for years and years and years. Reacquainted myself with an album I used to listen to a lot when I was younger, Transformer. Right, I'm giving up on Jordan. And that's just, I'm just giving up on him. So I've actually signed out. I'm going a different way. I don't know how this will work because it's a bit crazy and it's a bit short notice. But I've opened the Skype line to the programme. You can Skype the programme if you'd like to Skype the programme. And have a chat with me. My Skype handle is Chat with Richie. It's all one word, that's Chat with Richie. Chat with Richie. That's what it is, C-H-A-T with Richie, R-I-C-H-I-E. Or you can phone the programme. And the number is, if you're calling inside the UK, it's 0161 818 2018. That's 0161 818 2018. Or you can just Skype the program. It said Chat with Richie on Skype. You could Skype me or not, because I've got plenty to tell you in the meantime anyway. We'll figure out what happened to old Jordan a bit later on. Yeah, it was never going to be smooth, was it? First day back after a holiday. But there you go. Tweet the program as well. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Thanks for the tweets we've had so far. Hi to Paul Paranoid. Loving a bit of Lou Reed there. Thanks, Paul. Mark came back on to say about The Guardian. It's a disgrace, he says. And it is Zionist to its core, says Mark. I suppose The Guardian would at one time have been... yeah. How do I say? Would I say critical of? Would I say mildly critical of? Probably mildly critical of the policies of the Israeli government, probably, but never went far enough. As for The Guardian these days, well, I read it. I mean, I read all the newspapers on a daily basis. I've got the apps. I've got the apps on my devices, and I don't know. I'll have to have a think about it. I mean, when Seamus Milne was at The Guardian, he's basically the communications chief now for Jeremy Corbyn's office, for the office of the leader of the opposition, Seamus Milne. He's a guy who takes a lot of flack these days. He takes a lot of blame, does Seamus Milne, for the allegations of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, which is a nonsense, as you know. We've talked a lot about this. I'm not going to go into it now. Seamus Milne, but he was obviously a Guardian journalist for many, many, many years. And I think Milne was fairly critical of Israel in his reporting. But as for today, I don't know. I don't see very much about Israel in the Guardian newspaper in 2019, so I don't know. So I just don't know. Faisal says it's a feather in your cap when the mainstream media has a go at you without the right of reply. It's not so much a feather in my cap. It's the modus operandi now. You see, again, not to bore the bejesus out of you with the ethics of journalism, but my feet wouldn't have hit the ground in my time as a producer if I wasn't in regular contact with people whom were going to be mentioned on the programmes I produced. That was a given. And my bosses would have been constantly asking me, did you contact Mrs. X or Mr. Y to tell them they were going to be mentioned, to offer them the right of reply? And I would have said yes every single time, because I could do the basics. Whatever else about what I could and couldn't do, I could do the basics. That was basic, and that was sacrosanct. It was the most important thing. You know, one of the annoying things about being a radio producer, when I was a radio producer, was having to send out mini discs. This will tell you now how far you're going back. Mini discs of interviews to people who were mentioned. And phoning people. It was a royal pain in the arse. Hi there. Yes, how are you doing? My name is Richie Allen. I produce Daisha AM for WLRFM. Do you? I do. Listen, your company was mentioned on my programme today, and it was given a very negative mention. Well, what was said? Well, I'm sending a courier right now with the mini disc, and you can hear it back if you'd like to reply to it. You'll be given equal time on the programme tomorrow if you want. Because that's the way it is. That's ethics. That's very important. It doesn't exist anymore. It's not about me or my programme. It doesn't exist. It is common practice now to write a critical piece about somebody or something and not to give the subject of criticism the opportunity to say, hang on a second, hang on a bloody minute, let me tell you about why I interviewed these people on these various programmes and why I didn't. We have a call coming in. Before I say hello to the caller, you can Skype the programme for free. It's Chat with Richie, that's C-H-A-T with Richie, all one word. That's the Skype handle. It's never open unless we do a phone-in. We haven't done a phone-in in God knows how long. But the telephone number to the programme is 0161, that's Manchester area code, 0161-818-2018. If you feel like getting on the old dog and bone, caller, welcome to the programme. Who am I talking to?
Hello there, it's Steve here from Ayr in Scotland.
Steve from Ayr in Scotland. How you doing, Steve? Welcome to the programme, mate. How are you?
Yeah, fine. Nice to talk to you, Richie. I've been listening to your show for, must be a couple of years now.
Oh, well, thanks,
enjoy
mate.
It immensely.
Well, thanks for that, Steve. Well, I'll tell you what, mate, the floor is yours, so you can set the agenda now. If there's something you'd like to talk about specifically, it's over to you.
Well, I don't know. I go on your website quite a lot. Take part in the discussions on there. And I sort of post quite a few things, so...
Good man. Well, thanks for doing that. What sort of issues? I mean, I hear from listeners all the time, and they're kind of in different brackets. I have listeners who are very interested in health, in vaccines, and in general health, and in medicine and big pharma. Others are interested in military stuff, false flag operations. Others then take a more political kind of interest. What about you, Steve? Is it all of the above, mate?
I'm interested in all these things. You know, what you do, you provide a very important service, considering, you know, the what we receive in the mainstream media. There's a lot of nonsense that goes on there.
A lot of nonsense. Can I ask you if you don't mind, Steve? Can I ask you if you don't mind, where did it begin for you? My story is boring. It's been told so many times. It was kind of September the 11th. You must have had a moment yourself when you went, hang on a second here.
Yeah. Well, there's just so many things. I mean, climate change for a start. I mean, that's a big issue. And all you seem to get in the mainstream is just kind of nonsense about carbon dioxide, that it's a pollutant. It's just outrageous what they're saying.
And it's going to kill it. And it's going to kill us all if we don't stop producing it and all of that. Yeah,
that's right. And it doesn't take much research. I mean, anyone could go on the internet and basically find out that what they're saying is nonsense. You know.
Here's a question for you now. I'm not putting you on the spot. I'm delighted you're on the line, by the way. Steve from Ayr in Bonnie, Scotland, is live on the line. Thanks for coming on. It's funny you said the internet, because I've often said to people, Steve, well, look, if you go online, you can find stuff. And some of my friends who don't buy into anything that we talk about, they say to me, oh, that's the standard answer. You can go on the internet. So the question they put to me is, how do you know that what you read online is trustworthy? So I'm putting you on the spot there. When you go online...
Yeah, that is a good point. And what I do, I don't just read it from one source. I have a look at other sources as well and other people. And it's like triangulating something, isn't it? You reach a balanced view once you've looked at all the different sources and you finally come to a decision about any given subject.
You could have been a journalist, Steve, my friend, because that's exactly right. The first thing you do is you get a bit of information. You need to find out, are there other sources that are qualifying this? And if they are, well, then it's beginning to look more serious and more real, but just taking one source and running with it. I wonder, is that an establishment or an elite plan, Steve, to get us all into a mindset where we see something online, it makes sense to us, without even thinking about it, we start sharing it around, and ultimately that serves the system. But you sound like you're doing it properly.
That is the mainstream manipulation, isn't it? It's following a certain narrative. So it's directed by very few people, and they just want to push a certain view on something. But that's like, you know, things like Extinction Rebellion and Greta Thunberg. It's controlled opposition.
What do you think of Greta Thunberg? I think it's pronounced Thunberg, not Thunberg.
I think what she's being cynically used by corporatists, and I think it's disgusting the way young people are used as propaganda props.
I kind of go along with that. It's a bit depressing to see her getting a lot of personal abuse, even though I don't think she pays much attention to it from what I can see. And I'm not virtue signalling here, but I'm with you. I don't think she's the spawn of the devil. I just think she's a kid. And she has these ideas, and somebody has seen some uses for her, and they've put her out there front and centre, and I see her as being used as much a victim as anybody else.
Yeah, I mean, I've researched that, and you can see that you know, individuals like Soros are funding this thing. It's like with the Extinction Rebellion. The people that run Extinction Rebellion are actually, they're getting all the younger people, mainly younger people, to do all their dirty work. So what happens? They go on a demonstration.
That's a very good point, Steve.
They lie in the road or whatever they do, glue themselves left, right and centre, and then they're arrested and maybe charged and might get a record or something. And the people that are controlling it, they have no risk at all.
So the youngsters, in their enthusiasm and in their passion, are a more acceptable face than the people who are really behind it, because it's easy to unmask these people.
Well,
it's
very powerful, you see. It's the kind of, it shows you the power of the propaganda that's used.
I've had a question for you come in from my pal in Cleggan on the west of Ireland. What's the geoengineering like in Ayr?
It's not actually too bad. I mean, I do keep an eye on the skies, and I've seen a couple of things more towards Glasgow area. I've noticed things, but see, Ayr's on the coast, so I don't know if it's different on the coast, whether it's not as prevalent as maybe it's more inland, or
right. Maybe
more with concentrated population areas, possibly.
I want to ask you this, Stephen. There are other calls coming in, so I will move
on.
Sure. Thanks for kicking it off, mate, by the way, today. I'm delighted to have you on the program.
No problem at all.
Thanks for that. Before I...
keep up the good work.
No, well, thanks, but before you go, though, I ask this to everybody, and it's a boring question because I ask it all the time, but knowing, coming to understand things as you have done, that things are not right, that things are not good, and that we're not being told the truth, it has an impact on people, and it often has an impact on relationships. I always ask this bloody question. What's it like with you, with family and friends? Do they share your interest in what's going on, or is it? Did they look upon it as a sort of an eccentricity of yours, or how does it work?
I don't force it on anyone. I don't force it. I've got three daughters, and my wife knows what my views are. And I try to explain to them what's going on. But I think the thing is with that is that everyone has to do their own kind of looking into things. I can tell someone, but it's really no good if they're, you know, too either lazy or maybe distracted. Too distracted to find out these things for themselves.
Yeah, you nailed it.
But the more you find out about a subject, the more chances that you may possibly change your view.
I think you nailed it there. Yeah. There's only so much you can say without offending somebody or without turning
exactly.
them off you.
Yeah.
It's up to them then. Yeah. Steve, thanks for kicking it off, mate. Lovely to hear from you in there. And I hope we'll talk again.
Hope to speak to you again, Richie.
Thanks, Steve, mate. Lovely to hear from you today. Cheers, mate. That was Steve in Ayr there. Lovely to hear from Steve. Got a call coming in from overseas now, I do believe. Caller, you're live. Welcome to the Richie Allen Show. Who am I speaking with?
Hello, Richie. This is John calling you from Austin, Texas. How you doing, mate?
How you doing, John, in Austin, in Texas? And you don't sound like you originate from Austin, in Texas, John. You sound like you should... it sounds like you're closer to Steve in Ayr there. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, mate. I'm from Falkirk.
You're from Falkirk originally? Well, thanks for calling. Lovely to hear from you, John. So what are you doing in Austin, in Texas?
Well, I'm kind of sort of semi-retired country singer-songwriter.
Wow. Fantastic. Would you have anything online that we could find and play, John?
Unfortunately not. No, I never made it to that grade, mate. I had a wee unfortunate incident several years ago. Before I ever got the chance to record anything, I had a folder with all my songs in it. And technically it wasn't stolen, but I lost it. So it kind of screwed up my plans, as it were.
All right,
you know?
Okay. But you still perform, yeah. Steve. John, excuse me, you still perform.
No, my health's not great these days, mate. I have arthritis, so I can't really play my guitar that well. But let's not dwell on the negative
stuff. Let's not dwell on the negative, not at all.
So, it's just great to have you back, man, after 2 weeks. Really missed you. I've been listening to you, I guess, maybe just a little over a year, and I really enjoy hearing you every day when I get up. It's like 11 o'clock in the morning here when you start, so I'm just maybe on my first or second cup of tea.
Nice.
So it's nice to sit here with a cup of tea and listen to you. Because I never had much notice for about calling in this morning, so I don't have a lot prepared. But
we have all the time in the world, John. You have the floor. You can say what you want. I mean, the question I asked Steve earlier was, it's always relevant. What was the tipping point for you yourself in your life that made you start to look at other sources of information?
Well, funnily enough, Richie, before we had the sort of internet age, I remember one specific incident in my life. And it was back in 1984. I grew up working in the textile industry. And by the time when Thatcher came to power, you wouldn't believe the speed with which the manufacturing industry in Britain was shut down. And in 1981, I found myself working in the Philippines. I was there for a couple of years. And I came home. Actually, when I left there, I was living pretty close to your neck of the woods. I used to live in Altrincham, just south of Manchester.
Okay. Yeah, I know it well.
So anyway, I went to the Philippines and I came back and I thought, well, I'll try resettle in Scotland because I'd left there in 69 and went to live with my mother in Lurgan in Northern Ireland. Anywho, I see this job advertised in Hong Kong and I fancied going back out to the Far East. So I went down to London for the interview. I went down on the overnight train, had an interview about 11 in the morning or something like that. And I thought, well, I need to kill the day before I get my overnight train back up. So I decided to go and sit in the public gallery of the House of Commons. And what's his name was the Chancellor at the time, Nigel Lawson.
Nigel Lawson.
And I remember, I'll never forget this day, mate. He stood up and he said that Britain was witnessing an economic miracle. And I just kind of exploded and I stood up. I stood up in the gallery and I said, "You're effing joking, aren't you?" I hadn't planned to do that. I just instinctively did it. So, of course, I was walked out of the building. I didn't get in any real trouble. They just told me to leave, you know. But I thought, now, when I left Britain, there was about 2 million people unemployed. When I came back, there was close to 4 million people unemployed. And here's a Tory chancellor calling this an economic miracle. So that resonated with me, Richie. I never, ever forgot that. And years later, I started getting into it. When I came over here, I became a big fan of Alex Jones. And he actually had me on his show as a guest in 2014 talking about the Scottish referendum. But, of course, we all know what happened to that bastard. Excuse my French, eh?
Yeah, it's... Do you know, I'm not going to sit on the fence here because I have known him for so long and because he's done so many excellent shows and he gave a platform to so many great people. I kind of think of that rather than what happened to him and what he became, but I totally understand you saying that. And I don't want to sound like I'm sitting on the fence because, look, I've been critical of him as well. I mean, the Trump interview, that was it for me. I departed there, you know. It was dreadful stuff. But I'm sure I'll speak to him sometime in the near future and I'll ask him. I'll say, what happened to you? Why did you deviate from that path where, you know, you could see that it was all a farce. Politics was all a charade. Why did you jump on that right-wing yeah. bandwagon then. But can I ask you a question, John? Because you sound like you're a socialist. You sound like
absolutely.
You're a socialist. You remember when Tony Blair? Now you might have had more insight than me because at the time, obviously, I was a young man. I was just starting out in the media in Ireland, but I was very excited about Tony Blair. As what would I have been at the time? 22 or 23 years of age, and I was thrilled by what was happening or what I thought was happening in the UK, and that Blair was going to come in with all these ideas, and a lot of wrongs were going to be righted, and socialists were going to come to power, and boy, was I wrong. Do you remember that period? Would you have been excited about Tony Blair at the time?
I wasn't excited, Richie, but like you just said, I kind of was looking forward to what might happen. And I remember specifically thinking at the time, well, here's this guy, this young fella, and he's kind of listening to him talk. He's kind of bringing the Labour Party more towards the centre. But I says, well, they're going to have to do something to oust the Tories. And if that's what they feel is the right thing to do, then fine. That's all good and well.
What about John Smith? Before you go on, sorry to interrupt you. What about John Smith? Because a lot of real socialists, some of them very private people now, have contacted me over the years to say that John Smith was a socialist and they believe he was murdered.
I'm quite prepared to believe he was murdered. As to, you know, his socialist...
How left-wing was he?
I was a bit younger. I'm saying I was a bit younger. Hell, I was in my 40s, but... yeah, I liked John Smith. When I lived in London, I used to work sometimes at the House of Commons as a waiter, which is what most aspiring actors used to do in those days. Wow. And I remember I used to serve Robin Cook quite regularly. But you know, my favorite memory of those days, Richie?
Go on.
I had a roommate who was from Dublin. And he told me one day about all these buddies that lived in London. He says, they used to sign on the dole at multiple social security.
Oh, right, yeah, that old scam, yeah. We had that in Ireland as well. Yeah.
That tickled me. So anyway,
tell me about serving these men and women, these... politicians, Robin Cook, who died mysteriously. What were they like, these people? What were they like to serve, and how were they in private? Because they were in private then, cameras were off them. How did they behave, these people?
Well, it was like a regular canteen. You know, there'd be 10 or 12 of them sitting at a table, and you really didn't get to spend that much time at the table because you were going, collecting the food and bringing it to them. And I just remember Robin Cook being very polite and very friendly. And, of course, when he heard my accent, he was very nice. But what I loved about working there, mate, and this was my way of sticking two fingers up at Maggie Thatcher, I used to do the lunchtime shift, and my name would be John Day. And then I would go back at night and do the dinner shift, and my name would be John Knight. And I signed on the dole at the same time. So I was getting my wages for working in Parliament and sticking a finger up at Maggie Thatcher.
All of my conservative listeners are keeling over now. They hate you, John. You know that. They're absolutely sick now. They're sick to hear that. But what if you were never tempted to interfere with any of the conservative MPs' foodstuffs, were you? Be honest. Don't lie to me, John. I can smell the lies from across the Atlantic. Were you ever tempted?
Not the foodstuffs, but one of the other things we used to do was... And I was actually... I was actually Prince Charles's butler at a function one time. It was the 50th birthday party for the deposed King Constantine of Greece. And it was held at Spencer House in London, which I thought at the time was owned by Diana's family, but it turns out it was owned by the Rothschilds. But anyway, we used to work at a lot of these functions, like in some of the galleries, the History Museum and the Art Museums. I can't remember all the names of them, but I'll tell you, the one guy that used to show up there all the time was Michael Heseltine.
Oh, Heseltine.
And I'd be standing there with my big heavy silver tray of champagne and Buck's Fizz. And when I saw him walking in, I used to say to myself, boy, I wish I knew which glass he was going to pick up because I'd bloody spit in it.
Oh, Jesus. I'm not going to condemn that because I might have done the same thing, to be honest. It's been pointed out to me by my mate Gene Ann that Blair and Brown referenced the New World Order in speeches that they gave over the years. These guys were establishment stooges, weren't they? Blair and Brown. And as a Scotsman, I mean, you would have known about Brown when the Labour Party was in opposition, because he was a rising star in the Labour Party. And he was considered to be very left-wing, Gordon Brown. But they turn out... And this is why, I mean, you've heard me criticising Corbyn and McDonnell and Labour. And a lot of my friends are very much Labour supporters, and they don't like that, and they can't understand why a guy who claims to be a socialist, as I do, wouldn't support these guys. And I say, because eventually, give these guys enough time, and they've proved themselves to be no better or no more helpful than any of their predecessors. That's my opinion. What do you think, John?
Well, in those days, Richie, I really wasn't kind of paying attention, and I'll tell you for why. The Thatcher years, and then little Johnny Major who followed her, they just kind of destroyed my soul. And when I left in 98 to come over here, and I made a promise to myself that I was just going to cut myself off entirely. I didn't want to hear a bloody thing because I'd had enough of it. I was just fed up of being angry all the time, wondering, why have we had these buggers in power for so long? Look at what they've done to the country. You know, nobody has a decent job like when I was growing up.
This is interesting. Hang on, John. Let me stay with this. This is really interesting stuff. So you're saying that, because I never knew that, because I came a little bit after that. You know, a lot of my uncles and aunts emigrated, and a lot of their friends emigrated. But my generation didn't. I kind of came up in the later 80s, the 90s, the so-called Celtic Tiger, when things appeared to be better. So I'm fascinated by what you just said there. Talk to me about that level of anger. I mean, was that a significant factor in you slinging your hook and getting the hell out of the UK because you were angry at what was going on?
I think it was probably a big part of it, Richie. I was paying attention in the days when Kinnock was the opposition leader, and you know, he was up against Thatcher, and I was a big Labour supporter then, and used to take part in marches in London. I've kind of lost my track.
No, it was me bloody interrupting you, but I just wanted to stay with that you felt that level of anger, and I wonder how many people left the UK and Ireland in the 80s and headed for New York or into Central America. How angry were they at having to do that? How difficult must it have been?
I was just angry because I was wondering, what does it take to wake people up? Why are we tolerating this government running this country the way it's doing? Because I saw the social fabric of the country being torn apart. I remember the 3-day week, and I remember the miners' strike, which kind of led to the 3-day week. I mean, the thing is, Richie, when we have the information now that we didn't have in those days, and you find out the truth about people like Ted Heath and Leon Britton and Cyril Smith and Maggie Thatcher and her relationship with Savile, you just sort of scratch your head and say, why do we allow these bastards to rule our lives? You know?
Here's a question for you. Because I've come to the conclusion, not easily over the years, that no man or woman alive can do anything about it, because it's set up to ensure that no good man or woman alive can change it from within. So I gave up on voting, and I talk about it a lot on the programme, maybe too much. Where are you with that? Do you think I'm wrong? Do you think it's still possible?
No, I'm with you 100%, mate. That's exactly how I feel. Because I do kind of study it a lot here now. I've actually worked unpaid, as it were, but I've worked as a host and a co-host on several independent media outlets like your own. In fact, the last one, I got hired just a couple of weeks ago, and I took the place of someone who was a big, big Trump supporter. And I just happened to be talking with one of the co-hosts off air one day, and I said, no, I'm a socialist. And the next thing I know was I got a phone call saying, yeah, John, we're not going to use you anymore.
Is that right? Because you're a socialist. So that's a great segue there into Trump. So you were right in the heartland there. You're in Texas. How crazy is it? I mean, how polarized are people? We're given the impression on television that they are polarized and that people are turning against one another. Do you see that, or are we getting a false picture here in the UK over Trump?
Well, the thing with America, in my opinion, Richie, and I've lived here coming up for 21 years now, I can understand that they're not the best informed people in the world because of the way the media is set up. And you've probably got a fair idea of what American media is like. You've either got the likes of Fox on the right wing, who would just drive you crazy in a heartbeat, and then you've got the same on the left wing. You have the likes of these Rachel Maddow, or Madcow, as they like to call her, and then you've got these Muppets on CNN. They're not giving you information. They're trying to bloody indoctrinate you. And it just, if you're someone with half a brain who pays attention to what's going on, it just infuriates you. In fact, do you remember, I'll tell you another memorable incident in my life just recently. Do you remember the day the American embassy was moved to Jerusalem?
Yes, yeah, we talked about it, didn't we, yeah.
I was sitting here listening to your pal Mike Rivero that day, and the next thing I knew, mate, was I passed out, because when I woke up, I got my blood pressure cuff and checked my blood pressure. It was off the bloody charts. Well, I got rushed to hospital in an ambulance, and a couple of days later, I had a pacemaker put in. That's how I feel about the Palestinian issue. As someone non-American, although I'm not a citizen, but living in America, that really sticks in my craw, this relationship between America and Israel and what is happening to the Palestinians. I mean, let's face it, it's an ongoing Holocaust.
It's dreadful.
That's a genocide.
And because
it infuriates me.
And you know, because people are so entrenched, you beautifully described, if I may say so, what the two hands of the media do. They indoctrinate. You couldn't have said it any better. It's an amazing way you put it there. People into identity politics, into choosing a side and becoming very entrenched. And because everybody's entrenched, not just Trump supporters, but let's look at Trump supporters as a test case. They're so entrenched that they don't see anything wrong with Trump describing himself as the King of Israel. With Trump, you know, basically handing the control of the country and the country's foreign policy over to the Israeli lobby in America. So entrenched have they become, they're incapable of clearly thinking and looking at that issue. By the way, there's been a lot of tweets since you came on. Karen, I know Karen, she's been listening to the program a long time. She's a Glaswegian. She says that she's still angry. When she was a wee girl, she had to take three buses to a job that she was exploited for. Told the boss that told the boss could get people like me 10 a penny. The boss said, I can get people like you 10 a penny. I hate politicians, they all lie. And John Parsons is an Irishman living in Salford. I know John, lovely bloke. Very interesting listening to John, says John Parsons. I left Ireland an angry young man because of cronyism. I saw through Blair from the beginning and was very depressed on the morning of his coronation, says John. And Faisal says, this John the Scotsman in Texas is a bloody interesting bloke. I'm almost pleased that Jordan didn't turn up, Richie, says Faisal. That's a nice thing to say. And Steve James has echoed that as well. Thanks, Steve, for your tweet there. So you can see how entrenched people have become over Trump, John. And because I had this kind of theory that in the last 10 or 12 years before the election of Trump, I was very optimistic. I saw, or at least I thought I saw, the beginnings of people turning away from politics. And now it seems that the advent of Trump has re-engaged people in it. People are more interested in it than they ever were, because it's like watching a bloody soap opera. They can't get enough of it. All the rage tweeting and all that madness. They're totally hooked into it. What do you think?
Well, I think it's probably designed that way nowadays. I mean, I guess the spin doctors they're having the time of their lives, mate, because with the internet and social media that we have nowadays, it's taken on a whole new style, politics. But as I said earlier, I think Americans are very gullible because they're not the best informed people in the world. And I try not to be too critical, but sometimes, you know, when I'm in the grocery store, and where I shop is very near the campus of the University of Texas, and a lot of the students shop in this place, and I watch them, and I listen to them, and I look at their shopping trolleys, and I see so many of them buying bottled water, and I just feel like walking up to them and slapping them on the back of the head and say, what the hell is it with you? You're the kind of kids I see on Facebook yelling about climate change and global warming. Why the hell are you buying bottled bloody water? Buy yourself a filter, you muppet.
Yeah, or find out why your state is selling hundreds of thousands of gallons of water at pennies on the dollar to massive companies like Nestle in order to sell you back the water in a bottle that you bought for $2. I mean...
Yeah, I think... actually, Richie, I think... Is that not California?
It is California, yeah. California, yeah. You're 100% yeah. Right. I mean, how many of them would know that the water was siphoned out of California by a massive company, sold back to the American people for $1.50 or $2? It's crazy, John. It's crazy that people don't know this.
What other country in the world would they get away with that? As I say, they're brought up on American football, which I think is the dumbest game ever, and their basketball and their baseball and their American Idol.
Bread and circuses.
Yeah, it's.
Hey, let me ask you.
I don't see it changing in my lifetime, but.
Neither do I, but I'm not as pessimistic as I was before I went on holiday. There are a couple of more calls coming in. Just before I take them on, I've got one question for you, because you mentioned earlier on that you're dealing with arthritis, and I get a little bit of it now. I'm not going to whinge. I get a little bit now because of the knees and running and all of that, and I know it's terrible. You have it and you're dealing with it. Genuinely sorry that you are dealing with it, my friend, but what do you do about it? I mean, do you look into CBD oil? Obviously, that's been a big story in the States in the last few years with it being legalized in places. How do you kind of alleviate the symptoms of the arthritis, the pain? Do you use any of the alternative medicines?
I'm glad you asked me that, Richie, because it was about, I was approximately 40 years old. So we're talking maybe somewhere like 30 years ago when I was first diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. I was living down the Lambeth Walk in London there, and I had it for 2 years, and I was on a job one night, a catering function in Kensington Palace, and there was a guy showed up. I'd never seen him before. He wasn't one of the regular crew, and he gave me this book, and it was a book called The Tao of Health, Sex, and Longevity, written by an American guy. It was a translation of old Chinese medical cures. So a long story short, mate, I ate 3 pounds of black-seeded grapes for 5 days. I started on the Monday, finished on the Friday, and my arthritis was gone.
Wow.
Now, what brought it back, unfortunately, was when when I got married here, and I had to get American, what do you call it? I wasn't a citizen yet, but I was I got permanent residency status, and I had to take 2 vaccinations, and about just under a year later in that, the rheumatoid arthritis was back.
You had to take 2 mandatory vaccinations. When was this exactly?
2.
You had to take 2. And how long ago was that? Was that back in the 80s? Was it?
That would have been about 2007, I think.
No way.
2007, 2008.
And they said you've got to take 2 vaccines. What did they vaccinate you against?
It was just part of the process of becoming a permanent American resident. It had nothing to do with the citizenship. That came years later. But what bugged me about it was, I was able to get some organic black-seeded grapes again, but damn it, they didn't work this time, Richie. So whatever was in those vaccines, which I was very reluctant to take, and I shouldn't have taken them. I should have spoken with my attorney and said, look, do I need to take this? But I didn't do that. I just went ahead and bloody took them, and I've regretted it ever since.
Yeah, but a lot of people would have done that. I wouldn't beat yourself up. I might have done that myself in 2007. I might have said, okay, I'll have them as well, so... Wow.
But for you, if you're sort of in the early stages of it, there are certain cures. That, as I say, the black grapes, you have cherries as well as one. just look it up. There are things. Of course, over here, you have this. You have all these things that are, you know, we're looking for cures for arthritis and yada, yada, yada. And whenever I see anything like that on Facebook, I'll type in my grape, and it just disappears. They don't want that comment shown.
Is that,
you know,
right now? They delete the comment. Wow, eh?
Yeah.
Because there's obviously something to it, John. I've got Cliff trying to get through, and then I'm going to get Pfizer right on, I think. I just want to say, can I just say a minute?
Let me finish.
Go ahead, John. Go ahead. No, you go ahead, my friend. Floor is yours.
All right. Just, will you do me a favour? You know, I love you to death, mate, but stop calling Nicola Sturgeon me Jimmy Cranky, will you?
Fair enough. I think it's outlived its funniness, I think. Anyway.
I just want, more than anything, I want independence for Scotland.
I know, but you don't.
Toss about anything else.
I know, but you don't want to hand the country over to Brussels then, right? Come on.
That's, well, you and I know the story there, but it's like, if they've got to do that in the meantime, let's deal with that further down the road. I'm sure that people like Nicola Sturgeon are smart enough to know the score with the EU.
Well, I hope you're right.
Let's get out of the UK first.
I'm skeptical, but listen, I absolutely endorse Scotland's right to determine its own course. 100% right, John. And listen, I'm a man of my word. No more Jimmy Cranky and Nicola Sturgeon. It's finished. Brilliant chatting to you, mate. You've no idea.
Talking to you, Richie. Thanks a lot, pal.
Pleasure, John. Enjoy the rest of your day there. Wonderful stuff from John in Austin in Texas. Fantastic guy is John. Right, Cliff is ringing. Tell you what we're going to do, though. I'm going to take a tune before we say hi to Cliff. It might be Cliff. So, Cliff, stay there, my friend. I can't talk to you off air. There's a problem with my talk back. But if you stay there, I'm going to take a tune. And it's only a short tune. It's Johnny Cash. And it's I Walk the Line on the Richie Allen Show. Back with Cliff, I think, in a couple of minutes. This has been a fun show. Hi to Natalie Stacey, by the way.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line. I find it very, very easy to be true. I find myself alone when each day's through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you. Because you're mine, I walk the line. As sure as night is dark and day is light, I keep you on my mind both day and night. And happiness I've known proves that it's right. Because you're mine, I walk the line. You've got a way to keep me on your side. You give me cause for love that I can't hide. For you I know I'd even try to turn the tide. Because you're mine, I walk the line. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
The Man in Black, Johnny Cash, I Walk the Line. What a song that is. Two terrific calls, Steve and Eyre. Great to hear from Steve and Eyre. And John there, who's in Austin in Texas, a Scotsman living and working in the heart of the madness. Great to hear from those two callers. Cliff is on the line. I think it's Cliff. How you doing, Cliff?
I'm very well, Richie. How about you?
I'm Thrilled to hear from you, mate. Thrilled to hear from you.
Yeah, long time no speak. It was, I think, the Christmas before last.
It was.
I managed to get through, and that time has just flown. And I'm glad to know that you're in fine form. And I'm sure lots of your listeners are kind of a bit concerned for you at times with all the effort and all the hours you put in. And, yeah, whenever you need to take a break, mate, you take it. I know you have in the past, but, I'm glad to know you're in fine form anyway.
Cheers, mate. I had a lovely couple of weeks off. Didn't overexert myself at all. Just went local, stayed local, and slept better than I have for ages, Cliff. So, yeah, I'm really in good form. I'm looking forward to the next few months. And we've got some exciting guests coming on, people we've not heard from, and people I don't think many of our listeners will have heard from either. So I'm thrilled about that. These are mad times, Cliff. The Epstein suicide, stroke, murder, whatever the bloody hell it was, Brexit, it kind of feels mad. It feels frantic at the moment. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, there's so much going on everywhere, and it just seems to be everything. You know, it's very every aspect of all of our lives appears to have something being kind of tweaked by our elite in some way, and which is part of the reason I called, actually. But I'll come to that in a minute. But yeah, it's mad. Everything seems to be mad.
Chaos.
I think a lot more people are awake to it now. I know that I don't spend a lot of time doing it now because, like you, Facebook is just it's just at times just a waste of time. But I occasionally can't help myself and stick a post up. And as you know, I'm trying to do stuff to do with 5G. As you are very grateful for organising the program the other month as we were messaging.
Yeah, and, delighted to do it, mate, because it's vital, isn't it? Talk to us. For somebody who's listening to this for the first time, and there might very well be somebody today, they've seen the buses, and they're like, lovely, 5G, brilliant connectivity, download a film to my phone, happy days. They don't know anything better. They know no different. Tell them, why should they be concerned about 5G?
Well, on a number of levels, the easiest way to explain it, I guess, is that there's been no testing for the biological effects on us, according to the telecoms industry. Senator Blumenthal earlier in the year quizzed the telecoms people, and they said basically, well, we haven't done anything. There is no testing, although to some limited degree that we know of, it has been tested, and it's been catastrophic biologically for humans, animals, insects, plants, everything. It's just mad. But I think. Sorry, I was going to go on to say that the testing that's been done, as I understand it, the official testing, that because they tell us it's all okay, is on a plastic head filled with water, and it's for a duration of 6 minutes. And we're going to be exposed to something we've never been exposed for, 24/7, 365.
There'll be no escape from it. You mentioned Richard Blumenthal, this senator who was kind of tasked with questioning the industry. Has he gone away, Cliff? I mean, I've not. The last I heard of him was back in March or April of this year. Is he still on that case, do you think, trying to?
No, I honestly don't know. I've not seen anything from him. I know that there's several other videos that are available on him. I've not seen it, not read anything about him. But for your listeners, in terms of seeking information, because it's hard at first. You don't quite know where to go. Thanks to your guests that are numerous, it helps everyone to make a start to look. But there's the EMF portal is out there. There's the 5G space appeal, which is a very well written document, 10,000 plus peer reviewed studies on it, basically explaining that, almost my words, the science is done. It's harmful, and there's the I can't think off the top of my head. I can't think of it, but there's another one, bio I can't remember it, Richie. Under pressure here slightly.
No, you're not
remember.
Under pressure. No, you're doing really well, yeah. My friend. I understand as well there's a forthcoming conference in London, and it's being attended by a lot of academics, and they would be what we would call system academics. So they would be academics that the, let's say, the unawake, I don't want to say unawake, but the perplexed, as Jean-Anne calls them, the perplexed, people who don't know the information, they would see them as people of repute. So in London, I'm frantically, as I'm chatting with you now, Cliff, trying to find the link to it, because I did mention this before I broke up for my holiday, but a lot of academics are gathering in London very soon, and they're extremely concerned about the human health impact of 5G, and it's bloody doing me brains in now. I want to find it and promote it.
Yeah, you and me both. No pressure.
Yeah, anyway, look, it'll come to me, and somebody will tweet it to me now in a minute, and we'll get it out there. So the idea that the industry is settled on the idea that it's safe is a nonsense. We know that academics are putting their hands up to say, hold on a second, it probably is not safe, or at the very least, it needs to be studied before it's being rolled out. Plenty of credible system academics have said, no, this shouldn't be rolled out like this. And we know, of course, in Brussels recently, the Belgian Environment or Health Minister said that they wanted to stop it being tested because they didn't want the Belgian people to be used as guinea pigs. So, you know, I just wish more people knew this. But our media didn't even report on that.
What I was going to say, I think people were starting to realise that, well, maybe there's a problem in there, but they're not quite sure where to look. I say, I don't often go on Facebook, but sometimes I can't help myself and pipe in with a conversation on a local Facebook group. There was one just in this last week that said, has anybody noticed there's not many small birds around? So I couldn't help myself but then talk about EMFs.
Is there any truth in that? Let's stay with that, Cliff. Cliff is on the line. I know Cliff from corresponding with him. And Cliff does a lot of work on these issues, on this issue, to get people to maybe have a second look at 5G. So this is interesting now, because you know one of my bugbears, and it drives me mad, and I used to be guilty of this in a way, because I used to bring people on programs years ago, and I'd let them away with making wild claims without challenging them. Friends of mine have said to me, good friends, Richie, the birds, we don't hear them. They're not around the houses anymore. They're not singing. Now, that's not my experience in Salford. Where I am, there are birds. There are plenty of them. And it's a wonderful thing. It's a joy. It really is. I never thought I'd say anything like that, but it's a wonderful thing. But some people whom I trust implicitly, they're telling me that, no, where I am and where my friends are and where my gran is, the birds are just not there. The small birds, the bush-dwelling birds, are gone, or they have diminished. Is that your experience, Cliff?
Yes, it is. I mean, unfortunately, I have to admit that I am 60 years of age now. So I've seen a few years, and I can remember as a child and even up to 20 years or so ago, there was birds everywhere. They were everywhere. Where I live in North Essex, and there's still birds, but they're just not in the same numbers. They're just not there. There's very few insects now. For example, I've got a grandson now, and I bought a tent, and it's in the garden. It's hot weather. I thought, well, he can use that somewhere to go in and out of. And I actually slept in it last night because it was so hot. And so years ago, that would have been covered in insects. There's none. There's none. It's just lots of indicators. And also, you know, I'm not how can I put it? I believe stuff that goes on. I read the science. I'm guided by the science. The science is telling me stuff is going on. But I actually was working in the northeast, came back beginning of last week, and I was up there for a couple of weeks, and I happened to have to go into Gateshead to get some bits and pieces for the work that I was doing. And there's no birds. There's no small birds. There are no insects.
And you're looking out for them, right? You're specifically looking out for these small birds that live in shrubs and live in hedges that we see or we should see. Now, to qualify what I said, when I say I see them, I couldn't say that I see volumes of them, but you know, I do see them, and I'm not qualified to say whether there were previously a lot more. I'm not stupid. I'm guessing there probably were. I'm trying to be kind of half devil's advocate here as well.
There was loads of birds. Yeah. My mum still, bless her, she's 91 years of age now. She still lives in London, and yeah. So if I'm comparing places, you know, I don't live there anymore, obviously. But even where my mum lives, which is where I can compare my memories to, there just isn't the same numbers anymore. They're just not there.
Jean Ann has just weighed in with an interesting comment about windscreens and insects. And again, she's right. We've driven in the country last week, Carlin and myself. And you would imagine, driving your car in the countryside, that you're going to be constantly clearing insects from the windscreen. But in fact, I can say not one time.
No, not at all. Same experience for me when I drove back from the northeast. I had a few, but nothing like it ever used to be. So we're in to something that I don't know where it's going to end. You know, if all the small insects go, which there's not many of them left, you know, the indicator of that is perhaps the small birds that normally eat them.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, what Mark Steele says, that's why I mentioned Gateshead.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Mark, because a couple of people have mentioned him. Natalie Stacey has mentioned him. She's asked you, what do you think of what he's been doing? He's taken some criticism from some people. I refuse to get involved in any of that. He came on the programme. He answered the questions I put to him. He was nice. He had some interesting answers. He might have been on one time since then, but maybe not. But I know that he's been criticised. I know some people have accused him of exaggerating about the placement of the antenna, but I don't know anything about that. I'm not sitting on the fence here, I just don't know. So tell us about Mark then, what's been going on. I know about the court case as well, of course.
Well, Mark, everything that Mark says is from my reading of science and from some of your other learned guests that you have on the programme, is totally accurate. The reason I mentioned Facebook earlier, I'll link it back to where I was going, is that what people can't see, because EMFs are invisible, you can't see it. And of the 5G and the radar, as Mark speaks of, I haven't got the same lighting in my neck of the woods, so I can't, you know, and I wished I'd taken my meter and a big ladder, to be honest with you. That's the bit that isn't tangible. And I think that there's a sea change coming. I think people are starting to ask a lot more questions, just from my experience in this last week with being on Facebook and people clearly like having some concerns. You get the odd idiot piping in, and I'll just shut them up with the science there. They can't answer, as you always get. But there's people wanting to know, and they probably sit on the fence a little bit because they can't quite see it. So if that little aspect was kind of 100% proven, you know, with something that people can see, I'm sure Mark's criticisms just wouldn't be there at all. But everything Mark says, you know, from what I read and the science and in his videos, yeah, I don't disbelieve at all.
There's something that's crept into independent research, and I used to mischaracterise it. I used to think that it was jealousy and that it was hostility because somebody was getting some attention. And I'm wrong. It's not about that. It's about a real paranoia. It's a genuine, because people are so taken with these issues, Cliff. They're so animated by the need to do something about them, that they're suspicious of everybody. And if somebody gets a bit of attention, and if they get a bit of national attention, there are some activists, and I'm not thinking of anybody specifically, because some of them might be listening to the programme now, they might think I'm talking about them. I'm not. But some of them, they're that deeply embedded in it that they see somebody get a bit of national attention and they think, oh God, he's playing some sort of double agent, or she is, and they can't be trusted. And that's sad, but I do see that happening.
Yeah, which is why I think that if the bit that is invisible was made visible as such through, you know, here's a meter, this is what's actually happening, here's the absolute proof, then it would just nail it. It'd be done. And then perhaps all of the 5G activists may well be able to get, you know, behind each other and support each other. But, you know, there are, I mean, I'm perhaps no different, to be quite honest with you, because of you, Richie Allen. Because all this stuff has come out, you know, I never had any understanding of this 3.5 years ago. And now you're looking at everything and you do think, well, is that true? Is that true? That's the way it can get to you.
Cliff, hang on, hold that thought. I'm going to bring in Faisal because I said I would bring him in. You stay with me. Stay with me, Cliff.
Yeah, no problem.
We've got Cliff on. And there's another gentleman hiding in the background there with a crazy Skype name, but he wants on as well. I think it's a he. I'll try and get him on. I might not be able to. But this has convinced me to do more call-in shows anyway. So I'm going to make... I keep my promise that I am going to do more of these in the future. Stay with us, Cliff, and we'll bring Faisal in. It's telling me I've just got to do this, and then Faisal is in. I don't know why it's not doing it now. Merge calls, it's telling me, and I can't do it for some reason. All right, well, I'll try and figure out another way of doing it. Let's see. Bloody technology! What's going on? Oh, he's there now, I think, Faisal. Are you there, Faisal?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, thank God.
Say, slowing down later a bit.
Say hello to Cliff, mate.
Hi, Cliff. How's it going?
Yeah, I'm very well, Faisal. How about you?
Fine. I was just hearing the bit about 5G and you were saying about effects on wildlife and birds kind of going...
I've
been watching that for a few years, not specifically with 5G, but I noticed for a while, I kind of live in London and I go to Switzerland every year because I've got family there. And I noticed that around here, whether you were in London really in town or out in the sticks a bit around Nebworth where, and I was even in Wales, for years actually you had more wildlife here than in Switzerland. Like even here in town every morning, you'd hear a real variety of birds, like wood pigeons even, and the usual kind of finches and stuff like that. And in Switzerland, just almost nothing. There were a few crows flying around. The area where I live there is kind of known for that, but really nothing else. And I thought it was just a strange thing, and I asked my relatives and I said no, there used to be when we were growing up here in, you know, the 50s and 60s and stuff, that there were loads of birds and stuff.
Can I just say to both of you, Faisal, I'll ask you first, Faisal, then Cliff can come back in. It's crazy for me to be saying this all the time, but there are people listening to this and they're like, there's three lads now, they sound like they're fairly all right, they're fairly savvy, they're loquacious lads, they can speak. And yet, if they were pushed, they might say, all three, that this is some sort of agenda to destroy wildlife and maybe to destroy pollinators. Because I would have said some years ago, crazy, crazy, quack, conspiracy theory madness. But yet I do believe that there is an agenda to wipe out the pollinating species on the earth. You go as far as that, Faisal.
I'm not that sure. I'm not
you don't
that
know.
Sure, because it's quite puzzling. Like now that 5G has really come out, and I know parts of Switzerland have stopped it, but I think the part I was in hadn't stopped it, and so I don't even know whether it was rolled out or not.
How does that
but
work? Before this, sorry to interrupt
this
you.
This year, loads of wildlife's come back. I suddenly saw loads of birds all over the place. And heard them as well. You could hear them in the morning and notice this is the first time in years I've
in
heard
London,
that.
In London now.
Now, this was in Switzerland.
In Switzerland,
it's like
right.
Turned round. It used to be in London, you could hear it. And this is why I noticed the absence of it in Switzerland when I went over there. And now it's kind of gone the other way around, which is very strange.
Cliff, what do you think? The pollinators have been... I really do believe that. Again, you know, I can't provide irrefutable evidence to support that. My friends will say, come on, Richie. I suspect that there is an agenda. This whole thing that David Icke talked about for years about basically banishing rural and coastal areas and getting people into super cities. I think this is going some way to that. But anyway, what do you think, Cliff?
I think it is definitely an agenda. I remember Barry Trower on your programme, Richie. He described it as industrial genocide, I think, something like that. Now, whether people at that level realise the damage, I'm sure they do. I'm sure they realise the damage for cigarette smoking and hit it, same as asbestos. So I think there is this thing about, well, let's hide it for a bit so we can make a load of money. And then at that point, then we'll hold our hands up. And if there's a load of claims, then we will have earned more than what we pay out, because that's what always happens. I think then at that level, they probably know. But the higher level from that, I'm sure they know, because, you know, they're not looking after us. They're looking after whatever agenda they've got. And there's so many agendas. And in all honesty, what you said there was the reason I phoned up, just to say that agenda about getting us into smart cities. Mm-hmm. I phoned up to let you know that, I don't know if you saw it last night, I don't watch television normally. We just happened to put it on because we've been out all day and I was eating my tea. And I put it on and there was this programme last night about extreme weather on Channel 4.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah? That was the biggest propaganda show that I have seen in recent times.
I know, it's crazy.
Oh, every other word was mentioning climate change, or it seemed like it. And then they were referencing to the dam that nearly burst, you know, a few weeks back.
In Yorkshire, yeah.
And that was due to climate change as well. But
they kept contradicting themselves as well. They kept saying, oh, it's this aging infrastructure, a Victorian dam, and we really need to fix the infrastructure. So they were contradicting themselves as well. Like they were saying, the floods, you know, the warmer air holds more water and we're getting all these floods. Oh, but there's the water shortages and the droughts as well. And it was so confused. I'm thinking, what do the brainwashed think when they're watching this? Because it's so full of contradictions.
The lack of water part was filmed from last year when it was really hot. I don't know if you spotted that. So they weren't comparing it to this year, because this year we've had loads of rain and my garden has gone bananas with 8-foot weeds in places.
But even last year, I think you had floods in places.
Yeah, that's true.
And they were complaining about floods on the one hand and then lack of water on the other hand. And even in that documentary, you kind of wonder whether the people making it aren't maybe conscious of what's going on and are trying to sabotage what their masters are trying to get them to make, because they'd say, you know, that the infrastructure really is the problem here as well. That there's no money being spent on this stuff. And of course, if you've got an increasing population and increasing demands on there's more houses being built, more areas being occupied, more people using up less resources, and the infrastructure hasn't really expanded much, then of course you're going to get stuff like this. You're going to get a lot of water used up, and fracking as well. Nobody mentions fracking, how much water that uses. So then, of course, the groundwater is going to get depleted more quickly. And if nobody's doing anything with the excess water we get when it does rain, you know, when it just floods places and we're just trying to get rid of it however we can, then of course, that's going to be the problem. I did hear somewhere in Scandinavia, I think it was Denmark, but don't quote me on that, where they'd recently spent about, I think it's 50 million, which is not a lot, on a kind of huge system, a huge underground system under one of the cities, or even the capital, to alleviate both problems, so that you'd have somewhere for the water to run off when you had flooding conditions, but then of course you could store it there, and you'd have some you'd have extra reservoir space when there was a shortage of water.
Back to nationalising the natural assets of the country, aren't we? And not allowing corporations who will never plough the profits back into the underground pipework and fixing leaks. Of course they won't.
Oh, the myth of privatisation, which has been going since the 80s. It was the thing that really first turned me into a conspiracy theorist and got me really scratching my head at the population, because they'd be going on about how, oh, well, things are much better under privatisation. You know, it's... These kind of terrible governed nationalised institutions just can't do things properly. They don't have the incentives. You need nationalisation. Then a few years later, things got worse under privatisation.
Blair continued those policies, didn't he? That's right, mm-hmm. Faisal. Blair continued those Thatcherite policies. And you wonder at the time, we'll give Cliff the final word on this, you wonder at the time, were there journalists actually saying to government ministers, are you crazy? You're talking about selling this off to either Branson or somebody like him when it could be generating revenue for your cities and towns forevermore. I mean, just last week in Manchester, getting fleeced in an NCP car park, fleeced, 12 quid for a couple of hours. It's scandalous. Millions of pounds. And that's going into the coffers of a private businessman or private businesswoman. It's not going back to town hall where
probably
it could be used.
Probably abroad as well.
Probably abroad, yeah. Cliff, we'll give Cliff the final word then. We've got about 60 seconds left. Thanks to both of you, by the way. Cliff, 5G.
Yeah, thanks, Richie. Thanks, Faisal.
Well, tell you what, we'll final word on 5G, Cliff. Has the horse bolted? Are we just stuck with it now or what? Final word.
I hope that there will be enough people realising that there's a problem and that they don't sit back and do what we've all been indoctrinated to do, and that is hand over our power to a politician to sort it out or someone else to sort it out. People need to take action, and they need to get involved, and they need to get involved locally. The councils have a duty of care under health and safety, risk assessments, all that stuff. They have a duty of care to look after us. And whilst local councils say it's nothing to do with us, the government just implement it, that can't be right.
No, it ain't.
So there's a lot of battles to be had yet, I think. But you know, I hope people won't sit back. I hope people will stand up and be counted. And I'm hoping that they'll start to ask more questions, because they clearly are. As I say, linking it back to earlier. Yeah, just my little play on Facebook 6 months after the last one. A lot more people have a lot more concerns.
This particular issue might be the dam breaker, hopefully. Thanks, Cliff. Great to hear from you. Thanks, Faisal. Great to hear from you as well, man. Really appreciate your call.
Yeah,
both
all
of
the
you.
Best, Richie. All the best, Faisal.
Cheers, guys. Bye for now. Got to leave it there because that's the end of the programme. Now, listen, quickly. It's going to be a while before I get it on YouTube today because there are computers here. This is my fault. They're updating now. And it's going to take bloody hours, but it's going to be on Podomatic in a few minutes, iTunes and Spotify in a few minutes. That was the first programme back. We'll get to the bottom of Jordan Maxwell. See you tomorrow. Look after yourselves and one another. Bye.